We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, brought to you by Fantrax. I'm your host, James Anderson, and today I've got my buddy, Mark Winoker. We're going to talk auctions, and I know we talked auctions last week, but it's that time of year. Auctions are so much fun, and Mark is a much more seasoned auction player than I am. We're going to go through some of the auctions he's already completed, what he was looking to do in those, and how it all turned out, and then he's going to kind of go over my big auction that I completed, and we'll talk about some areas where I maybe went wrong and could have made some better decisions. But first, Mark, since, like I said, you're a seasoned auction player, why don't you give the people an idea of just kind of how many NFBC auctions you've done in your life?
Hey, James, really appreciate you having me back on. I have done 51 NFBC auctions starting in 2015. That includes four NL only and two AL only. And I really miss those, but it's gotten so much tougher with the way the teams, you know, deploy their personnel now to make those really viable, at least for me, as far as the amount of work. But interesting story, back in 2015, before the NFBC had software of their own for auctions, we would auction on RT Sports, and then they would have to move all the results over to the NFBC platform. And Todd Zola and Andy Saxton used to coordinate and facilitate those. We would actually do the 7-round reserve draft via email. So that just tells you how far the NFBC has come with their software. And now it's all, you know, in one spot and much easier. And I don't have to bug Zola to tell people to pick their 27th round pick.
That sounds like my Tout Wars draft and hold slow draft him in right now. Todd Zola is the moderator there, and we got to kick some people into gear there. So that's a lot. So over 50 NFBC auctions. The 500 DC auction I did was only my second NFBC auction. I've done a lot of other auctions for keeper leagues, RotoWire staff, leagues and stuff like that, but only two for me. So you are the person with the wisdom here, and so we're gonna pick your brain about a lot of cool auction topics. How many are you gonna do this year?
So I'm gonna do 7 or 8. I am teetering on the brink of falling for one more, just so I have a more recent one before Vegas to try to get in tune with the market that's changed since February. I'm doing 3 in Vegas, 2 1500s and a 2500. I have a 500 online one the day I get back from Vegas, a little FOMO auction in case there are players I don't get in Vegas that I feel like I need to have for the season so I could grab them in that last one. And that's all. I'm actually only doing auctions this year. I wanted to pare down the number of fab teams. I wanted to streamline my prep. And I find snake and auction prep very different. So I didn't want to have to toggle my brain back and forth. So I'm missing out on the main this year, which is really rough. I've been playing it, I think, since 2016. But I just kind of made a commitment that I'm going to lean into the format where I've had the most success recently, and that's auctions. And so right now, unless there's a very late change of heart, only doing auctions this year.
Well, that's cool. I mean, that sounds like you've got a nice sort of plate of really important leagues. And there's definitely nothing wrong with paring down, and definitely nothing wrong with kind of doing the contests that you like the most or you have had the most success in. So definitely understand that. Just a quick little plug. I got an email from Greg this morning. If anyone wants to get into a main event, the first one in Las Vegas a week from today, we need two more entries to fill that one. We've got Rob DiPietro, John Posma, Jason DuPont, Matthew Shepard, Sean Childs. So just a bunch of decorated players in there. So the only way you'll ever see that draft board is if you join that league. So definitely get in there if you're going to be in Vegas a week from today. But Mark, you've done so you did the three online ones that you shared with me before this, and like partially, as you said, it was kind of a prep for the ones you'll be doing in Vegas, the bigger money ones. So what were some kind of lessons that you learned in those early ones that maybe you can apply to some of the bigger money ones?
Yeah, I'd like to do those. And I made it all the way to February, which is the longest I have made it to not draft in a decade. Like I really, it's a lot of willpower to not draft until February when all your friends are drafting earlier and you're kind of chomping at the bit. So I was really waiting for all the projections to come out so I could do my aggregate projections, create my valuations. And, you know, then I want to test run those, right? So each time I run a valuation file, I want to kind of test them out, see what the market looks like, and start to play around with a few builds that might be viable for Vegas. The first lesson is what I call the theory of relativity. And this is really an evergreen lesson I take from these auctions. And that's, you know, every auction economy is different. Everyone says that, but it's true. And you really have to look at your team relative to the other teams in the league. So the key is to put together the best possible team compared to your league mates. You know, when you look at an auction board after and it's in a vacuum, you could always notice the holes that are there. The key is to have less holes than your league mates. So every auction, I just try to put together the best possible team for that auction and execute the strategy as best as you can. It's never 100%. But if I can out execute, at least in the auction format, I have a slight leg up to start the season. Then, you know, then all the fun begins with fab and lineups and all that stuff. So theory of relativity, just having the best team relative to your league mates, I think, is crucial. The second one is just money management. And that is, I think, maybe my biggest skill in auctions. And it comes with practice. Like, that's what you get from doing 50 auctions, is you understand the money management portion of the game. And so it also is a corollary of the theory of relativity, is I want to position myself relative to the rest of the league in regard to where I'm at with money. So I'll typically start the first seven rounds, and at least online, the first seven is before the first break. I'd like to be in like the top three in money for those first seven rounds. I'll grab a few top tier players, right? I don't want to miss out on a first or second rounder and just start, you know, all my players in the third round. But I'm typically out on the very top tier, which I always have as overvalued based on my analysis. So I let people do all the crazy bidding, and I just sit tight, get a few guys, so I'm not like stuck at the end with too much money. Typically then after the break, that's when I'll strike. That's when a lot of my players who show to be at retail or maybe slightly under, those are mostly my targets. So I'll swoop in rounds, you know, 8 through 10 and 11 usually, and I'll go from top three to maybe bottom three. But I'm comfortable because I've probably gotten six or seven guys. And then usually all the big spenders who maybe sat out those few rounds, they come back in and they're fighting each other. And again, typically overpaying in that next tier. So then, you know, by round 15 or 16 after the second break, I'm back kind of high middle. And if I could stay there for the rest of the auction, that's great. So I have a little ability to get the guys I want at the end, and I'm not just stuck with $1 guys. So I think money management is always a key lesson. I think for this season, there's a couple of more specific lessons. So one is the inventory, you know, at each position. So in the three OLACs I've done, what I noticed is the starting pitching, there's like an ebb and flow to how the pricing goes. Top, really expensive. Then it kind of dips down to kind of retail. Then it bumps up again to the SP3 tier, very expensive. Then the SP4 tier kind of ebbs down a little bit. And then again, it kind of perks up again and then kind of slows down. So kind of to know like the ebb and flow, like I want to be fishing at low tide, right? And I want to let everyone else kind of fight the riptide part. So if you can kind of either sense or just through experience know where the pricing is going to go for a particular position, especially pitching, that'll keep you out of trouble from getting in those overspend situations. So I think the ebb and flow of the inventory of pitching is really important. The last lesson is this year, closer and catcher is really flat. There's a lot of options at both positions. So the pricing is pretty flat. There's not a lot of high or lower options. You know, in the past for catcher, you have a few 20 plus guys, maybe a 10 or a few 10, and then, you know, down the fives. Now it's from 9 to like 13. There's 8 to 10 catchers and, you know, and a few higher. So I want to have a pretty solid catching and pitching strategy, which I didn't execute in the first three I did. So I want to just resist the temptation to maybe get like a William Contreras for a $5 discount when I know that's going to bust that catcher budget. And now I'm going to have to make a concession at a different position. So I really want to try to execute catcher and closer this year within the budget I have for them. And there's plenty of guys there to make it happen. It's not like I'm just counting on two closers and two catchers to make a budget. And I think we'll talk about that a little later when we talk about your auction.
So when you were talking about the pitching and how the top guys go for a lot, and then there's kind of a drop down to sort of guys who go for retail, who's involved in that sort of retail bin? Is that kind of like the Logan Webb, Framber Valdez range? Is that like Freddie Peralta, Pablo Lopez? Like, where does that kind of retail range kind of fall?
You nailed it. Peralta, Pablo, Webb, that tier, the Freed, Gilbert tier, that looks to be perking up. I checked AAV last night for the last couple of days, and all of a sudden Freed has gone from like 18 or 19 to 23. So I will note that this is going to change a little bit. So that's why I was thinking of maybe jumping in one more. I don't want to add a fab league, but I also don't want my first Vegas auction to be the first one I've done in 6 weeks, and I'm caught off guard on a higher money one. So yeah, you nailed it. That's kind of the tier where the pricing is a little closer to valuation. They're still overpriced, you know, per my file, but it's about, and this is what Ariel Cohen says all the time, it's about relative overpays. Pay a little bit less over than other people are doing. And again, that's the theory of relativity. That'll keep you in a better budget situation if you do that.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to see those prices in Vegas with the, it feels like there's been more guys just kind of being removed from the pool this spring than even your normal year, at least. Seems like we've lost about like five or so of the top like 35 starters, 40 starters.
I got Cole, Gausman, Snell, Gray, Montgomery just in the top 35, like two haven't signed, you know, three are injured. You know, then you got Bradley, Gavin Williams, Braxton Garrett, Lodolo, Edward Cabrera, who's maybe coming back, Taillon, Boz, Sheehan, Bradish. Yeah. I mean, that's like another, there's a good 10 to 15 in the top 100 that are already, you know, diminished or even totally gone. So, and unfortunately, there's two more weeks to go, James. It's not over yet.
Yeah. Senga and Giolito too.
Yeah, I have them further down the file. Bradish. Yeah, exactly. Senga and Giolito.
Yeah, so, man, it's going to be wild. in Vegas. So yeah, you sort of had similar builds in the three that you did, where you were kind of going, getting a good starter at the four infield spots, it seemed to me, going cheap at middle and corner, and kind of three, like you were talking about with, at catcher. It seemed like you sort of tried three different kind of ranges of which kind of caliber of catcher you're ending up with, and but very little overlap on those infield buys, and then you had a bit more overlap with your outfield buys. Is that kind of was that surprising to you to not really have much overlap at all with your infielders and your catchers on those three auction teams?
Yeah. Well, the one surprise was that I had Benintendi in two leagues. That was surprising. If you had told me today, Mark, that I would have two Benintendi out of three, I would be like, why? But, you know, those are reserve round picks. And, you know, he just shows up really well in the valuations as being someone who, you know, should be selected at some point. So I've been just scooping him up. Yeah, so generally I'm more of a spread the wealth type of player. So there's basically two camps. You know, there's stars and scrubs, spread the wealth, and then of course there's hybrids or mixed versions of those. So traditionally I like to have four strong infielders. I like to get, you know, a couple strong outfielders, two good catchers, and that's typically how I play it. You know, this year I've decided I want to be a little more aggressive at the top end and try to get a couple 25 plus or 30 plus bats and trust that I can get some $1 and $2 guys that a little later that can provide some potential profit. So that's like in the first one, I ended up, I think, with Olsen and J-Ram. So I went for two bigger bats there. You know, that requires you then to go cheap at middle, corner, and UT. And I think there's some good buys in those positions this year, so I'm pretty comfortable there. I was trying to kind of lay a foundation in the first three auctions of a bunch of players that look good to me and that I at least know I have on one team. And since I'm only doing, you know, seven or eight teams this year, where I typically would do a dozen or, you know, two dozen, you know, in years past, I'm not going to have as many leagues. So, you know, I wanted to get some guys early. I'm expecting to build on that foundation in Vegas and start adding some duplication and some overlap as we go on. I'm not going to have eight totally different teams. You know, I think the first three I ended up with what I had. The one thing I noticed in outfield is some people love to pound outfield and then they go cheap in the infield. Some people like to do it, you know, the opposite. What I've noticed is outfield this year, I love a lot of the five and under outfielders. There are, I feel like I can get three at least out of my five that are five and under and feel really comfortable with. They seem to be really underpriced. People love to grab the top outfield plays, and those guys are great, but if you spend 40 plus on those outfielders, that really limits what you can do later. So if I can get a couple $20 outfielders and then three under five, that makes the ability to get a few higher price bats in the infield potentially, and those two good catchers. So I think that's kind of generally what I'm thinking for this year.
Yeah. I think with the player pool this year, especially for a fab league, I completely agree with you. I think I'd rather kind of my weaker spots on my fab league roster be like my last two outfielders and my corner middle, and util. And then like, you know, having those really locked in awesome starting infielders and catchers with a couple locked in really good outfielders, I think that's a really nice base. I think you kind of achieved that on those three auction teams. So another thing I noticed is you ended up with six different relievers on your three teams. So is that just the way that it fell, or are you kind of purposely trying to not end up with like the same closer on like three teams?
Yeah. Closer's the one position where I was not happy at all with the first three OLACs. I generally really like what I did, especially not doing any DCs, just coming in cold and just draft, you know, auctioning three teams, you know, after, you know, a long off season. Felt a little rusty, but felt good. But I botched closers, in my opinion. You know, I was going in, and this is a good lesson. You know, don't go in and saying, oh, Evan Phillips' AAV is 10 and Clay Holmes is 10, so I'm good, 2 for 20. Well, of course, when one goes for 14, now all of a sudden, you know, you're like, oh. So, you know, you have to be flexible, be prepared, know what the AAV is. Of course, in Vegas, we won't know, you know, what the big money AAV is. I'm in the first auction on Thursday. So that's, you know, there used to be New York auctions, so you'd have a little intel heading into Vegas, but we'll be setting the market, so to speak, in that first auction. So I'm not happy with what I did. You know, I think the first one, all the targets were going $3 to $4 over AAV. So I ended up, it was kind of a little bit of a panic pick grabbing Romano there, who I'm, you know, I'm not as high on. I still like him, but he's probably closer to like my RP 10 than, you know, a 5 or a 6. And, you know, I paid 17, which is not horrible, but it's not great. I could have got a Class A for 17 if I had been a little more in tune with what was going on. I just didn't want to get shut out of a RP 1 tier. So I ended up grabbing him. And I got Alvarado for 5. That's looking a little better now. You know, his price has gone up to 8 or 9, and they haven't added anyone. I don't expect him to be the solo closer, but that's not a horrible second pick. You know, I got Class A in the second one. I'm okay with that. But then I ended up with Helsley. I'm like, oh, 13, that's a good deal. Well, I don't really like him. His injury history, and now reading that he's probably going to be more of the high leverage reliever. So I kind of hate that pick now. And then the third one, you know, I think I got a good buy on Devin, but obviously that looks horrible now. And then I have Kenley. So I have two guys who are injured. So I might have nobody, but I do have Tyler Kinley in the reserve round. So, you know, Greg Jewett said he likes Kinley. So I'm banking on those Colorado saves and that team. That should work out great for me. So I'm going to have to figure it out for Vegas. I need a better strategy. I need to really lock in on the guys I really want and figure out the budget for what I'm willing to pay. But that was not my intention to have 6 different ones, and certainly 3 that I really don't care for that much.
Yeah. So with Williams kind of being a diminished option at this point, like, how are you, do you sort of, when you go into that first Vegas auction, like, do you go in with like, this is what I think the prices are going to be, or do you just try to adapt? Do you see what like the first 2 or 3 closers go for, and then you just adapt from there?
I mean, I'll definitely go in with the AAV, average auction value, for the last X number of auctions right before Vegas. So I'll probably take the last 5 auctions over a couple day period. And that's at least my baseline. And that's how I kind of construct my strategy. I do look at my valuations, what the AAV is. I create a difference column, and that informs what I do. You know, I probably take more of a mathematical approach than a lot of auction drafters. A lot of great auction drafters who are field drafters, they kind of know who they like, they know how to price them, and they know how to construct a team. I have a little more of a, I'm kind of from the Larry Schechter school. Winning fantasy baseball is kind of how I got my base strategy for auctions. And, you know, I've tried to evolve that. But this will get into, I think we talk about nomination strategy, but yes, I think it's really important for those type of positions, catcher and closer, particularly those early closers usually, stay with closers. That those first two closers will kind of set the market, and then you'll get a better idea of, oh, okay, everyone's going to be a couple dollars over, or, you know, maybe it's going to be a reasonable market. The one thing I am expecting with all of the upward pressure on starting pitching pricing this year is that closers are going to stay relatively stable, because we only get $260. You know, you can't pay up for every single position. It's a zero sum game. You know, up until now, and, you know, when we talk about your auction, I have some thoughts, but basically it's a 95-165 split, so 95 pitching, 165 hitting. that's going to go up in Vegas. So let's say it goes up to 100 or even 105 for pitching. Most of that extra 10 bucks is going to be for starters. So I just don't see closers all of a sudden jumping up there, especially with the inventory and how many options there are. So that's one position where I'm expecting some stability. And then, you know, the extra money you have to pay for that pitching side is going to come out of the starter budget.
Yeah, I think you're probably spot on with that. Okay, yeah, let's head to a break. We'll have a message from our sponsors here, and then we will get into some more auction strategy questions with Mark. So if you're watching this video on YouTube, please like and subscribe. Really appreciate that. This is just a baseball-only YouTube channel for the most part going forward, so definitely appreciate your support there. And if you're playing in dynasty leagues, especially, you really need to be playing on Fantrax. I'm still in this Tout Wars draft and hold draft that I think it might have started like over a month ago at this point, and we're only in round 36. And I would be much more annoyed if we were on a worse draft platform, but it's a really aesthetically pleasing room. It's very easy to build a really deep queue and find the players you're looking for without spending too much time on it. So I just love that we're doing that on Fantrax. And Fantrax, I think, is one of the best places to find an open dynasty league. They've got forums where if you're looking to join the dynasty league, you can find something on there. So sign up for free today and be entered to win an official MLB signed jersey from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Simply go to Fantrax.com/RotoWire and sign up today. That's FANTRAX.com/RotoWire. Fantrax, the home of fantasy sports.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And it's officially fantasy baseball season, and it's time for MLB Best Ball on Rival Fantasy. That's right. Rival Fantasy now has Best Ball. Full season lobbies are live now until opening day with both fast and slow drafts. Then weekly and daily drafts will be available from opening day through the end of the World Series. Best Ball is all the fun of the draft without the season-long management. Enter a league, draft your squad, and the app does the rest. No need to set your lineup or make waiver moves. The highest scores at the end of the regular season will be the winners. Invite your friends and start drafting for the 2024 fantasy baseball season today. Sign up at joinrival.com/RotoWire for a $200 deposit match and $25 in free entries. Welcome to the future of fantasy sports. Welcome to Rival Fantasy. Okay, back with Mark. And yeah, we mentioned nomination strategy just briefly, but definitely wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that. That's something I spent time thinking about, but definitely not something that I feel I've anywhere close to like mastered or anything like that. So where do you kind of begin with nomination strategy?
It's such an underrated aspect of auctioning. You know, I think money management and nomination strategy are the two most understudied or under-discussed topics and potentially two of the most important. And those are two where I think I have some experience with, and I feel like I have a grasp of it. So it's interesting because I hear a lot of great players talk about auctions, and I'm a little surprised at their nomination strategy. You know, it's typically you hear, I just want to get money off the table. Yes, you do. That's absolutely the goal of nominations. However, how you go about it is what is I think what's the is the strategy piece. So I have a couple different approaches. One thing I like to do early is nominate mid-tier players that I have going well over their valuation. So I think they're way overpriced. These are typically your helium guys, and I want to throw them out early so the people who are in on them have to pay the premium and they don't get a chance to get them for cheap later. The top, 20 hitters and pitchers are going to go for what they're going to go for no matter when they come out. And there's plenty of other people who don't have a nomination strategy, and they'll just click on the top guys in the queue. So I don't worry about them. They're going out anyway. I want to use my nomination to get out a mid-tier guy who I have is maybe $8 or $10 over his value, get him out early, make the person pay up, and then that's how I get money off the table. So that's probably my most used version. And I basically use my file. I look for that difference column, and I put it in red if guys are overpriced, at least per my valuations. And then I create a little nominations tab with the top guys in red, and I throw out the ones that aren't like the obvious options. So that's number one. Number two, and this is what a lot of people use, and it works. Once you get a position, I like to then nominate other players in the same tier of that position. So other managers have to pay a similar price for that similar talent level. So, it could be any position, really. Other players in that same tier that are still there, get them out soon after I just paid retail or whatever I paid. So they have to pay pretty close to that, and they're not getting a discount. I hate when you have two or three guys in a tier that you like and you end up paying the most. So I try to make people pay something similar to what I just paid. Another one is scouting. The auction player, the auction manager pool, so to speak, is smaller than, say, the DC manager pool or OCs or mains. There's a solid group of people who do auctions. So you invariably auction with them and you know some of their tendencies, and more specifically, you know the guys they like. So if I'm in an auction with someone and I know they like this player and I have them as not being of value, I'll throw them out. So I'll kind of use scouting a little bit when it is warranted. And in Vegas, I'm in auctions with the same person three different days in a row. So I'll have a pretty good sense after the first one, and especially the second one, of who they like. So I might try to use that against them, in that later auction. At the end of the auction, there's another strategy I like, and that is throwing out the remaining players who still have an AAV of, say, $3 to $5. Towards the end, there are still a few players who are typically going for that amount. So I will try to throw them out to get that last remaining dollars from some of the teams that still have a little more money than I do. And that'll set me up better for like the dollar and $2 players. And, if you throw one of them out for a dollar and you get stuck with them, it's probably not the worst thing, because their valuation is probably higher than that. So yes, you might get stuck. You have to be careful at the end when you're nominating, when the money starts to run out. But if there's still a few $5 guys left that have been going for that consistently, I'll toss them out, make sure that someone doesn't get them for a dollar or two. And then of course there's the strategy of throwing out guys you want, right? You can't always throw out guys you don't want. So obviously end game, it's dollar days, right? So you better make sure you're throwing out guys you want, because you're likely going to get them. And you don't want to be playing around at the end, say, hey, here's a dollar guy that someone might pay two for. Well, if not, you're getting that guy. So you have to like the guy. And the other one was what we talked about earlier, James, and that's testing the market. So earlier on, throwing out a closer, throwing out a catcher, throwing out one of those second tier starters we talked about, and just testing the market. Also, if you have like a very strong plan A, so last year, Ohtani was my plan A in all the auctions. So I want to know in the first 15 nominations if I'm getting Ohtani, because if I'm not, I got to pivot to plan B, and you have to pivot pretty quickly in these auctions. That's another thing. You have to be very agile, very nimble, and move on a dime. So if my plan A is dependent on one particular player, I need to know right away if I'm getting them or not. And sometimes that can backfire. You know, you could throw them out early and it just explodes and you're out. But sometimes it doesn't. You know, the early noms, the very early noms sometimes are a little more tepid. So that's another strategy, is throwing out a guy that is part of your plan A and making sure you know if you can go with that plan, you know, right away.
It's all very useful. A lot of good ways to kind of attack the nomination strategy there. And I mean, it's just, yeah, it's one of the layers that makes auctioning so much fun and such a, you know, like I said, I've only done two of the NFBC ones, and I feel like I've got to do like another 10 or 20 at least before I kind of really feel sort of comfortable in every facet of it. Now, one thing I love about auctioning on the NFBC is the max bid tool. Just such an awesome tool. If you haven't auctioned on there before, you're able to kind of set your max price so that you don't get kind of caught like trying to hit bid and then it gets to a different level. How do you use that tool? Are there any kind of things people need to be careful for with it? Do people overuse it? Do people underuse it?
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic. It's very interesting because it creates a potential edge or advantage, which I'll talk about, that is not open to live auction players. And it's interesting this year with, you know, three of the auction championship leagues are online. It's something that I think they should frankly consider, you know, the equity or fairness of some auction drafters having that at their disposal and some not, but we'll kind of get into that. So just real quick, one thing to be careful of is, you know, a lot of people will go in and basically you click on the player and it has a little box that says max bid. You type in an amount. And what happens is, let's say it's Vlad Jr., just for to make up an example, and say your max bid is $28. So someone nominates Vlad for $15. Okay. The next person who hits 16, if you have the max bid at 28, it'll go to you for 16. So that person will hear like a buzzer. That means someone else has made that bid. Then someone goes 17, buzzer. It goes to 18, jumps to 18. It's still you. Jumps to 20, jumps to 22, jumps to 24, jumps to 20. So sometimes you're just like hitting that button like six, seven times in a row and it keeps buzzing. Eventually you get to that person's max. So if their max is 28 and someone hits 29, then it finally goes over to that other person. So just so people kind of know how that works. So a couple things. I don't like using it that way. Okay. I don't like to, on higher priced players, to have it that way, because basically it's a tell, right? You are basically, it's very obvious you want this player and you're willing to go to a certain price. I like to be in the mix with bidding. I like to go a quick bid. I like to wait to going once. I like to wait to going twice. I'm trying to hide my intention as much as possible. I don't want someone to know that they can just keep bidding me up and I'm going to take the guy. And a lot of times, honestly, the people who use max bids frequently usually set the max at like the AAV. So I don't really know. I guess if it stops right at AAV, that's where there's a slight edge, because you will be the first one to get them at that $28 price, right? So if you know I'm not going over 28 for Vlad Jr., then okay, that way you're forcing someone to go 29. So I understand that. One way people can get in trouble also is if you have a lot of max bids set up before the auction and you end up forgetting about some, and let's say you get your two catchers and then you have a third catcher that has a max bid on them, you might end up getting a third catcher. Now, it does, the cool part about the technology is when that player is nominated, it gives you a little like caution button.
Right.
That says, are you sure you want to keep it? Or, you know, I can't remember the exact wording of it, but you can click off the max bid, but you have to be paying attention, right? You know, we're
about 5 seconds or so to kind of get out.
5 seconds. The dogs are barking. The kids are crying. You know, the woodpeckers are doing whatever they do. So you have to be paying attention. So if I have a few max bids, I'll go back and make sure I delete those before that. If I've gotten those positions, I'm going to give out my big secret, and we're here to serve the people. The best use of it is in the end game. I love to do this move, and that this move is as follows. You can put a max bid of $2 on a player. You can nominate them for one when it's your turn to nominate. If no one else clicks two, you get them for one. If someone else clicks two, you get them for two. Now, not always. There are circumstances when multiple people have the same max bid on a player. And I think it's by whoever does it first time-wise, but it's a little vague. They really don't have a tutorial or really explain kind of the mechanism behind if two people have the same max bid. But I tell you, it works at least 3/4 of the time, if not more. So that's where the big edge is, right? Like, imagine you're in Vegas and you tell Brady, okay, I'm nomming this guy for one, but my max is two. So if someone goes two, just make sure you give it to me for two, right? That doesn't work in a live auction, but it does in an online auction. And it's a massive advantage, right? Because you might get them for one. If not, you get them for two. So honestly, I think that's something they should be considering when they're having these $1,500 auctions online. I think that is a big edge for online players. And it's something I use a lot. You know, you could also just have a max bid of two. And if someone else noms one, you know, it'll go to you for two if they haven't done that. So that'll probably ruin that strategy for me. But, you asked and I had to share it.
Yeah, well, that's a really good way to use it. Probably, still more important that you identified the right guys to set that up with ahead of time, right? But that's a great way to use it. And a really good point about like when I was doing my 500 DC auction, I had some max bids set up on catchers and closers, and definitely on the fly, like quickly scrapped those once I filled those spots. So that's a good thing to be mindful of.
One thing I would say, James, I mean, I think initially, and I think this still carries, is the idea was no one wants to sit at home and auction for 5 or 6 hours, right? They have to have these to be done in, within 3 hours, let's say. So that was the intent, because, sometimes people go one, two, like on Acuna, one, two, three, like max bid, boom, right up to 50, right up to 60, whatever the number is. So it certainly moves the auction along in the early stages. So I think, I think that was the intent of it. And I think it's valuable, but there are just a few little wrinkles that you could take advantage that end up, I think giving an edge that maybe was unintended in the original conception of the max bid feature.
So you talked about kind of scouting when you've got multiple auctions with the same player. How much are you paying attention to players during the auction, not thinking about like the next one, but just that specific auction? How much are you paying attention to what everyone else is doing, and how do you use that?
I think I mentioned earlier, the main thing I look at is everyone's money. So, at home, I have, a three screen setup. I got my file. I have obviously the auction room, so I could be bidding and seeing who's being nominated. I would love if Greg's listening, I would love a feature where when a nomination happens, his voice announces the player. That would be such a huge thing, because, if your head's down on your file and you're not noticing a player that's been nominated. Now, typically I'll have a big queue to start, so it'll kind of ding when a player is nominated that you have in your queue, so you're kind of alert to it. But it would be great to hear that nomination. That's one advantage of live auction, right? The auctioneer does mention the player multiple times, so even if you're looking at your file or your ranking sheet or whatever form you use to track players, you'll kind of hear it. So the main thing I pay attention to, of course, is other people's money. And that's on that grid view of the auction where all the players are placed. I really, again, want to balance kind of where I'm at relative to everyone. As far as bidding, honestly, you know, I know some people really try to pick up tells. I know like basic poker strategy, you know, like I'm not a great reader of people in a sense of like an auction or poker. I think in like life, I have a good read on people and their talents and things like that, which comes in handy at work. But so I'm not like trying to like stare someone down and get like read, you know, look into their soul. You know, are they going to go the extra dollar? Are they not? Like, I don't like to play around like that. I don't like to price enforce and just, you know, think someone's definitely going to go an extra dollar. There are a few players who through the years you can kind of rely on will. So I might mix that up. However, if someone is like constantly going twice on me, that's where I'll get a little bit attuned. You know, if I think I have someone and someone's jumping in right at the last second. So that'll kind of make me mad a little bit sometimes if it's the same person. So then I'll try to figure out how to throw them off that scent, you know, so I'll try to quick bid them or I'll come back and do that to them. You know, I'll try to mix it up so maybe I could have them stop doing that to me, try to reverse the annoyance so they get frustrated and kind of stop. So I think that's the time where I look at if someone has a consistent pattern where they keep, you know, late bidding me, I'll try to see if I can figure something out to kind of throw them off doing that.
So this is one of the biggest challenges, I think, in auctions. And I think I've heard you talk about it before, and you mentioned it at the beginning as well, but kind of the importance of saving money for the end game so that you can go two or three on your final targets in an auction. You know, maybe you get fortunate and you get a few of your favorite targets for a buck, but kind of how important is it to you to make sure that you're not dollar days on like your last five spots? And like, how do you kind of like, how many times do you successfully pull that off and just kind of the challenge involved with that?
I think you want to have some $1 players. I always, at the end of an auction, add up how many $1 players go. It's typically around 60. So that's like four per team. So I think you want to be in that $3 to $4 range by player, because those players, if everyone's doing it, then you're not like getting really crappy $1 players. You're getting some good $1 players there. And there's typically some profit potential on those guys. If you're getting no $1 players, then you're missing out on that potential profit. And you're potentially overpaying for some marginal players in like the $3 to $5 to maybe $7 range, where they're not massively different than those $1 and $2 players. So I think one key strategy is you want some $1 players. Now, what I don't like is to get five in a row. Like, I don't want to leave myself $5 for five players. I like to mix in some of those dollar players when I still have $8 or $9. I get one $1 player. Then I'll get a $2 player. Then I'll get a $1. Then I'll get a $3. That way I'm kind of picking my spots to get those $1 players, and I'm not forced into just whoever's available. So I think, you know, the other strategy around having $1 players is we're going to churn a third to a half of our rosters, right? So all of those players are going to get dropped at some point. You know, dropping a $1 or $2 or $3 player is probably the same thing. But, you know, when you start dropping $5, $6, $7 players, that starts to hurt a little bit. So you're going to drop a lot of those $1 players anyway. So you don't want to have all, like, you don't want to spread the wealth so much where you have all like $8 to $20 players where you're having to churn some of those guys. So I think you want to have some $1 players. You know, I think if I have 10 for my last four or five, I'm in great shape. But as you said, that happens maybe 50% of the time. You still want to go and get the guys that you value the most at the most important positions, and you don't want to just be skimping. and not going that extra dollar on a key player that you really think ties your auction together, and just to have the extra dollar or two at the end. So I think it's important. I don't think it's imperative. I think you want to have a few $1 players, but you know, I like to have a few $2 and $3 players too, if possible. So as much as I could save back at the end, you know, was it your pod? Someone was saying they have like a $10 like slush fund at the UT position that they then can kind of you know reallocate.
Yeah, that was Jason last week. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. So I was listening. That's good. That's kind of interesting strategy. I'm usually a little more specific in how I have an allocation across positions, but Jason's a great auction player, and I think that's an interesting strategy where you have that little slush fund, and then you can start moving that around where you need to, instead of starting at $1 at UT and not leaving yourself that kind of room.
Okay, so reserve round strategy, and then we'll get into all my mistakes, but reserve round strategy. What do you got there?
Well, a good friend of mine has an amazing article that's going to come out today on reserve round strategy. So I'm not going to dip too far into that. Hopefully people can find that out there. And I think it's an amazing analysis. The one thing I would say is it's more like the psychological component of it. So the one thing about auctions and snakes, you know, listen, a main event is a grind. You're mentally fried after the 3 hours, no question about it. Auction after the 3+ hours, you are definitely mentally ground down, because at least in a main, you get a little bit of a break between picks. You know, you're still thinking, but auction, the misnomer is you can get every player you want. That's not true. You can only get a certain amount of players that you want, because you only get $260. The saying that you're in on every player, that is more true, meaning you could be bidding on a lot of players. You could be thinking about bidding on a lot of players. So you have to be mentally in tune to pretty much every nomination. So by the time it's time for the 7-round reserve, and just so folks, you know, who haven't played a lot of auctions, you get 260 for your 23 players. And this is important. You have to have a valid starting lineup. You have to have a 23, 9 pitchers, 14 hitters. It's different than a snake draft where you can get your two catchers in round 29 and 30. You can't do that in an auction. You must have two catchers at the end of the 23. You must have 9 pitchers. Then the last 7 players that make up your 30-player roster are in a snake draft format. They give you like 5 minutes to make that pivot. So you have to turn off your auction brain and turn on your snake brain in like 5 minutes. And that's where I sometimes struggle. It's a big shift. So what I like to do is toward the end of the auction, start to be on a pad of paper, jotting down where I think I have a weakness, either at a position or a category. So let's say my corner is a first baseman and my third baseman is, let's say, Royce Lewis. And, you know, he has a little bit of an injury history. I might want to get, if there's still a good remaining third baseman out there in the reserve round that has an everyday job, I might write down third base. If I feel I'm a little light in speed, I might write down, SB. So I'm reminding myself, hey, I want to get an upside steal guy if possible. And also starting to add to a queue. This is where live or in online, start filling your queue with reserve round players that you have identified. And that's some early prep. You should have a tab or a list of reserve round players that you are potentially interested in. Start filling that queue so you're not going to miss one of the people you're interested in. But also, a few players will fall out of the auction into the reserve round. You want to make sure you're not just laser focused on your reserve round list, that you are identifying those players. Last year in Vegas, I was able to get Justin Steele in the first pick of the reserve round. That ended up being a massive help. And I had him as going in the auction, but I was able to, in my file, indicate that he hadn't been auctioned. I had to ask someone, I'm going, is Justin Steele still here? Because like it didn't make sense. And I was able to get him. So make sure you don't miss on players who should have been auctioned, who haven't. have a list ahead of time of your reserve round, start filling your queue, and then diagnose your team's strengths or weaknesses so you are getting players you want. You know, the other thing is what kind of reserve, you know, bench spots do you want? Do you want a lot of pitching? Do you want a lot of upside plays? You know, I think you want probably a mix. I think you maybe want an upside guy or two. You might want a closer spec. You might want a few more starters because starters are hard to come by. And then you might want to fill a category or positional weakness that you have. So that, I think that's generally the reserve round, just like a broad overview of that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't easy. It was not hard for me to dissect what I needed in the reserve rounds after my $500 DC auction, which was completed over a week ago. And I shared with you sort of a kind of a rough plan ahead of time, and then obviously shared with you the results. And just kind of to give the listener sort of an idea, like I've got two good catchers, Will Smith, Francisco Alvarez, for $31 total. I've got Josh Naylor, Gleyber Torres, Xander Bogaerts, Royce Lewis as my four infielders. Went cheap at corner and middle, Marcell Ozuna, kind of expensive at util. And then Corbin Carroll, Wyatt Langford, Seiya Suzuki as my three big outfielders, and kind of cheap with the last two. So I kind of did everything I wanted to do on offense, but then I did almost nothing of what I wanted to do on the pitching side. And I got Craig Kimbrell and Raisel Iglesias as closers, which was the one thing I kind of set out to do. Spending 33 on those two closers. But my SP1 is Chris Sale. Certainly would not have hoped to have him as my SP1. And then things really fell off the tracks from there. I ended up going kind of completely off of my list of players I was going to buy in the auction, and ended up buying Brian Wu as my SP2 just because I couldn't afford any of my actual targets there. And then it quickly disintegrated from there. So I went with pitching with my first five picks of the reserve round. So I might be drawing dead. I might be almost drawing dead. We'll see. I definitely thought I was drawing dead right after the auction. I like how the reserves played out. But what do you got for me, Mark? What are some notes and some areas where I went wrong and can improve in the future?
Yeah, this was fun. You know, you gave me your spreadsheet with top targets and then secondary targets with some prices. And then you shared the board and I was able to really dissect it. I spent a couple hours on this. It was, I kind of enjoyed that this process because, you know, it helps me think through how I structure my teams and also how I set out my targets and my pricing and then kind of how the auction plays. So the first thing was your top targets implied a 73-187 split. And you actually ended up at 72-188. And I try to stay pretty close to my split because I spent a lot of time working on that. However, the room ended up going 101-159. So you were the lowest spender at pitching at 72, and that's a massive gap. I mean, you almost never see a gap that big between what the room does and what you end up doing. And that split has Ohtani as a hitter. I know on the board he was included as a pitcher, but I'm adding him as a hitter. So my question for you is, and the one thing we should mention is this is a DC auction. This is very different than a FAB auction. I'd say very different, but it is somewhat different. People have different strengths. One of your strengths is clearly getting late pitching. I'm assuming you thought going in pound hitting, you have a great feel for late pitching, and that was kind of the mix you were going for. Clearly, you had some other higher SP1, SP2 targets that were going to anchor the staff that you weren't able to go for. So did the DC auction format drive your kind of split going in, or were you a little surprised at how aggressive the room ended up being for starting pitching?
I definitely planned on starting pitching being my weakest part of my team. And I would have certainly been, I would have been okay spending the least of the entire room on starting pitching. The big problem was that a lot, like basically all of my sort of preferred late to middle round SP targets went for like double their AAV, you know, just way more than their AAVs were coming in. And this is a loaded room, no surprise, you know, $500 auction DC, got Steve Weimer in there, Gecko's in there, Bobby Big Bucks. So just, you know, really a loaded room. And I definitely, you know, there were certain teams that just kept getting all the guys I wanted. So I was just kind of like, all right, well, he's kind of thinking the same thing, and he just has more money than I do to make it happen. So I was planning on going cheap on starting pitching. I just wasn't planning on the cheap on starting pitching leading to the starting pitchers that I ended up buying.
So I think a lesson that's kind of, I think for all auction players, frankly, not just new auction players, is having more targets or guys you like more than you think you're going to need, right? So, and you share a spreadsheet. It's probably not, it's not inclusive of all the players you like, obviously, but it was fairly sparse, I thought, in regard to kind of who you were hoping to get. And I think that is one thing that goes back to the one misnomer about auctions, that you can get anyone you want. So people go in going, here's the five guys I'm going to get, and I'm going to guarantee to get them. I think what I like to do is have a much broader group at the different SP tiers or RP tiers, or really any position, where I have green and yellow, right? So green is, these are the guys I really want. And then yellow, these are guys I like, and it's price dependent. If I get priced out of my green tier, I at least have some fallback. So I think just having more potential options, like as you mentioned, you ended up with Brian Wu, who was not even on your board, and you ended up getting him. That's the one thing I think you, and I like Wu, maybe I don't know that you don't, but you know, I think that's one area where if I leave an auction and I look at my team and I have some guys like that that I really didn't have on my green or yellow list, and maybe they're a red or like a very light yellow, that's where I get a little bummed that I did not execute, because I probably should have had a few more targets up there. So I think that's an important thing, is having more either targets or players you like. We have to be realistic here, James. Our targets are everyone's targets. You know, we have come so far in this game. There's just no secrets anymore, like in the movie Sneakers. No more secrets. It's everyone likes the same guy. So your targets are everyone targets. You have to have guys that you're willing to say, I like this guy. I prefer to have a better guy, but everyone wants that guy. And I only have $260, so I know I just can't get everyone that I want. So you ended up getting 6 out of 14 of your top hitting targets and 3 out of 9 of your top pitching targets. So 9 out of 23. And I think that's pretty standard. I mean, that's about what you can expect to get. So just know going in, if you're new to auctions, you're not going to get the 23 guys that you want. It's never going to happen. It's okay to have that list and have that vision and that structure, but just know it's not going to happen. You got your two top closers in Iglesias and Kimbrel, but you paid $4 more than you had, you know, your number being. So, and honestly, I checked. The only pivot was like Seawald at 13. Every other closer that you had listed were going for 3 or 4. So I like that. You had two guys you wanted. You knew the market was $2 over on each closer, but you got the ones that you had at the top end. So I think that's fine, because basically everyone overpaid for closer. So did you, but it was the same relative overpay, and you got the two guys you want. So if you're going to overpay, make sure it's the guys you want. I think that's really important. You mentioned, at least in the show sheet, about, you know, maybe going Gavin Williams for the 10 instead of Wu. You know, he's a guy you wanted.
That was my biggest regret of the auction, like in the moment, because so it was like kind of Gavin Williams and Hunter Brown and Bryce Miller were like three guys that I really wanted as sort of, you know, my low end SP2 or maybe sort of my high end SP3, depending on how things shook out. And Williams went for the cheapest of the three. He was the first guy to get auctioned. And I was just kicking myself the rest of the auction for not going 10 on him. And with Brian Wu, I like Wu. I don't like him enough for him to be like someone I was sort of planning around necessarily. But that not getting Williams, I basically had to go down into a tier that included Wu that I wasn't planning on going into. But I mean, it just based on the news on Williams, like I won't be drafting him anymore this season. So that part, I guess a little bit of luck there, but in the moment I was really kicking myself for not going 10 on Williams.
So like in that tier, you had Ober who went for 3 over what you had. You had Bryce Miller who went for 6 over, Brown 2 over. And I think Gavin maybe was 2 or 3 over. So what I think a big error is passing on someone you like at retail, holding out for a bigger target that then goes way over your number. And then you're forced into making that purchase or pivoting to someone like a Wu or something you don't like. So in your defense, Gavin was not at retail. He was over. So you might have had a reasonable expectation that one of the other guys would go a little more closer to your number since Gavin went first. And often nomination order does influence pricing, right? You know, obviously early on it could be higher, end of the tier higher. You want to be in that middle, you know, range where typically a guy might, you know, go where you have him. So I don't think I would beat myself over that one. Really, all of your SP targets, none of them were going at retail. They were all overpriced. And that 101 split is a good $5 to $6 over what the average has been. And think about that. That's $6 per team. So that's an extra $90 that went to pitching that hadn't been up until that point. That's a lot. That's a dollar or two on a lot of, you know, on the top 40 players, you know, so to speak. So I would just say if a guy is in that tier that you're interested in and you have him as either a top target or a secondary target and he's at retail, don't get greedy. Just take him. And yes, you might end up a guy you like better might end up going for a better price. And that just happens. You know, it's not like a snake draft where you know exactly who's left at the exact time you're picking. This is nomination based and all that. So I think you did okay there. It was just maybe having a few more options at each of those SP tiers that would have given you, you know, an ability to maybe grab a guy at cost. But I didn't see a lot of guys going at cost. That was a massively aggressive room there, which is what might be happening in Vegas, I'm afraid.
Do you think I should have? So I think my top, in theory, if everything went perfectly, like Freddie Peralta was going to be my SP1. He goes for 28. Do you think I did the right thing in not staying in there?
Yes. I mean, love Peralta this year. Looks like he's in that, you know, in that tier we talked about earlier where it's closer to retail, still a little bit over, but $5 at 28, you know, now you're getting up into the Kirby and Pablo and Yamamoto zone, even though those guys probably went for 30 in this one. I don't have it in front of me, but no, I have a limit on guys like, and that's why you have to have maybe a few other potential options there for that one. You know, Mike Mager and I are partnering on a few auctions in Vegas, and you know, we're trying to talk through that top SP strategy and making sure we have multiple top targets, not just one, multiple, and we'll do our best to get the one that makes the most sense at the time. But I personally have a limit where I won't go over, and you know, I think Peralta hitting 28. Is probably that limit. If it was 25 or 26 and you were sensing the room was $3 over on every pitcher, then that's okay. That goes back to that theory of relativity, right? If everyone's overpaying, it's okay for you to overpay. And in this case, that $5 overpay is probably what everyone was overpaying. So maybe you could have done it, but you know, this is your first auction of the year, I think, or NFBC one. So You probably had a more reasonable expectation that you would have been able to get, because I think you had Castillo, Kirby, Gallen, Pablo, some other guys, and yeah, they all Gallen, went for
Gallen went for 26. Gallen was probably
that was the one two over that one. Maybe you know you could have snapped him, but it's
my
tough.
My other thought afterwards, I do want to talk about Wyatt Langford in a second, but my other thought with just how I could have done things differently is I took Xander Bogaerts at 15, and I love Bogaerts this year, but I just – there's a lot of shortstops I like, and I think if I maybe go with a – you know, whoever it is, like – you know, maybe I go five on Zach Neto. Maybe I go eight on Ezekiel Tovar. Maybe I even just take like Mason Wynn. Mason Wynn was like the clear best hitter available to me in the reserve rounds. But I couldn't take him because I just felt like I needed to pound starting pitching in the reserve rounds. Maybe I get Mason Wynn for a buck. And then I have $14 from the Bogaerts purchase to apply to a starting pitcher. That was kind of my top idea sort of in hindsight of how I might've done things differently.
Yeah. I think with the higher pitching prices, the hitters went much closer to your numbers. That's why you were able to get more of your targets. The hitting prices were in line with kind of what your expectations were. You know, the shortstop purchase was interesting because you did get Bogey kind of at the number, but you had Swanson on that list too. And he went for $4 under. I'm assuming that was a nomination order thing.
Yeah,
like, yeah, yep. You would have snapped up Swanson for that discount had he gone before Bogey. So yeah, so that's why, you know, when people look at auction boards after and try to critique, it's not like a snake draft where you can literally tell this person took this guy over this guy because he went after. It's a temporal order thing. That doesn't change. In an auction, you don't know who was nominated first. So a lot of times people could be critical. Oh, how can you take Bogey for five more than Swanson? Well, Bogart came out first. That's, you know, that's how that happened. And there's no crystal ball to know that Swanson's going to come, going to go cheaper. But I think you kind of hit on the dynamic there. And that's having a thorough analysis of inventory at each position. So if you know shortstop is deep and you're comfortable with like a $7 Tovar, who you ended up getting anyway as your MI, if you're comfortable.
I didn't. I got. Ahmed Rosario is my MI.
You didn't get Tovar. So, right. You correctly identified Tovar going for seven. So if you had stayed with your read on that, you could have ended up getting one of your bolded guys in Tovar for seven. That gives you So you had 15 and then one on. So that's like maybe an $8 difference. That $8 could have been huge for your starting pitching. You could have potentially upgraded your SP1, your SP2. So I think if you keep, you know, people do this in snake drafts. They're like, oh, you know, first base deep. I'm not going to get an early first baseman. I'll get a first baseman, you know, in the, you know, 10th round or whatever. Same with auctions. Like if you know there's a nice group of $7 to $10 or $5 to $7 players at that position that you're super comfortable with as your starter, then just kind of hold tight and execute that. But, you know, it's often tempting when there's a guy that you do like a Bogaerts, and he goes around the price and you just like, oh, I'm going to take him. I really like him. And then that $8 could have really come in handy pitching. So I think you're right. Know the inventory each position. Stick to your read on that and you'll get the guy that you want later for the price you want. And then that extra dollars can go to another position.
So I mentioned I got Wyatt Langford here for 14. And this was, I want to say March 2nd, March 3rd, something like that. It was the day, I think we were auctioning during the game where he hit two home runs. I didn't know he hit the two home runs like when we were auctioning. I don't know how many people in the room did. But I just really wanted Langford. I think he's awesome. He went for more than I was expecting, but not so much that I was out. And then in your, you did your four or your three OLACs before spring training, and he went single digits in all three of those. I am really interested to see sort of where he goes in the main events and how much he goes for in the main or in the Vegas auctions. But sounded like you maybe had some regrets for not snapping him up in one of those OLACs.
Yeah, the third one. I think he went for five. I mean, that's egregious. And it's funny. In these online auctions, you could have your hand on your mouse and you're hovering over that $6 number, yeah, plus one. And like your brain, like you just can't make yourself hit it. And I think I did that with Langford. I'm like, oh, and then I just did. And then I kind of immediately had regret. And then, of course, now, because back then it wasn't like 100% guaranteed he was breaking camp and he, you know, spring training hadn't started yet. You know, who knew how he was going to react? Obviously, I knew you had him, you know, at the top of your prospect list, and someone definitely. And this is where I get in trouble a little bit, being a projection-based, valuation-based, you know, drafter or auction player. Right? He clearly, you know, with his playing time and probably more tepid projections for, you know, for a prospect, he just was even at $6 showing as a little bit of an overpay. Right? Obviously, I'm going to readjust his playing time and he'll come out, you know, higher than that. But I had other guys that I thought I could get for $5. Like I ended up getting Starling Marte, who I had valued more than Langford. Now, you know, looking at it now, I'm like, I wish I had switched that around. I still do like Marte, and I have to get at least one Met. I'm contractually obligated to get one Met on every team, so he was my only Met. He's going, James, $15 in the last five OLACs in the last 2 days. So I think I won't be shocked if you see a $20 purchase of him in Vegas. I think he'll be between 15 and 20 in every auction. And I could see him breaking the $20 barrier if there are two people in an auction that really want him. So, yeah, obviously knowing I could have had him for $6 is a regret. It is a 150, so I'm not like losing sleep over it. You know, if I had done that in a bigger auction, I definitely would.
Yeah, this is an interesting case because you know, like last year, I really liked Carroll, but he was going like fourth round all winter, and then he was going third round. Whereas Langford, you know, he's going in the middle of the 100s all off season, and now he's going in the like 70s. And so kind of making that adjustment and then like kind of deciding like where to draw the line on, you know, where is the line where it's like, okay, now he's overpriced. I haven't had to do that calculus with a prospect this good in a few years. I know like Julio Rodriguez, I think Julio Rodriguez is a pretty good comp for Langford from just a like readiness standpoint and a fantasy output standpoint. But he was, if I remember correctly, like, he was still going like around like pick 200 or something like that. And then he just jumped way up into like the top 100 in a matter of days after it got announced he was going to make the team, because there was much more uncertainty with him because he'd only reached double A the year before. There were still the sort of same kind of, I think most people thought he was probably going to go to the minors until it became clear he wasn't. And then it just flipped. Whereas Langford, I'd been drafting him all off season, expecting him to make the team. And now the price is like doubled. So I'm still kind of sorting that out. I've got a main event tonight with Todd, and I'm in the first main event in Vegas. Again, if anyone's in Vegas and wants to join that one, we got two spots left. I'm still struggling with what to do with him in my next snake draft, just because I haven't been in one, or I guess I was in an OC last week where he went in like the 70s and I just didn't even consider him there. But I honestly don't know what I'm going to do with Langford in the main events yet.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You just brought back some trauma. That year, J-Rod went for $1 in a Vegas auction, and the next day he got announced he was coming up. So someone got him for $1. So talk about missed opportunity there for 14 other teams who didn't go two on him. You know, it's interesting, the dynamics. So like Churio has been going in the mid double digits the entire offseason because he had signed that, you know, signed the big contract, and it was pretty clear he was going to make the club. And, you know, Langford, it was more uncertain. Now Langford's, you know, has passed him in, I think, is going to end up being, you know, going for more than him in his last big ones. There was one more question on the outline you had sent about, you know, that valuations in February, you know, what can you take with you moving forward? So I think it's kind of, I think it's relevant to this conversation in that, you know, you have to, this is one thing I like about my new strategy of waiting till February. I am not stuck on any given player or any given strategy. Like, I haven't been drafting since November. I don't have this muscle memory of I have to take this guy or I don't like this guy. I'm coming at it a little bit of fresher, but even if you've been drafting that long, I think you have to kind of be real with yourself, look in the mirror and be willing to change or admit that maybe this guy you shouldn't be on as much, or maybe the guy you've been fading you should be on. And you have to be willing to kind of reassess what you've been doing. So I think some valuations will change. Obviously, the injured players, the prospects that they're going to make the team. I guess like Terang is going to be a starter, so his projections have to change. His valuation might be very different. I think the large majority of players who are still healthy and have the same role aren't going to change. So I think you still can bring a lot with you from the early drafting. But, you know, I think even like, you know, like Mike and I's process where we went through every single position, did our green, yellow, red coding. We have to go back and redo that one more time because a lot of, you know, some material things have changed, like Cole going down, et cetera, where a few guys, we're going to have to, you know, shift some more guys into the green zone and a few more into the yellow zone, now move some guys to the red zone, right? So I think you have to be consistently and constantly open to changing your mind and to rethinking what you've done so far and what you do for the final push here.
Yeah, I think that's just really good advice for fantasy in general, is just not being kind of so stuck to like your priors and being adaptable to, you know, maybe there's a player you just had always been out on. You shouldn't just stop looking at that player. Like, you need to keep looking at every player and see if something's changed. But then if you're like changing your mind about a player, I think you want to make sure you're changing it based on either something you found or something someone you really trust like told you or something like that. You don't want to be changing it just because of the way the wind's blowing and like the like fantasy Twitter or whatever like that. And I think with Langford, like the biggest challenge is, it's like, I love the player. I think he's a good pick in the top 100. But every pick you use in the top 100 on a position player is a pick that you're not using on a pitcher. And so making the pieces fit, you know, you can't just be like, well, I got to get this guy at the expense of making sure you get the pitching you've been getting in every draft already. And so that's the big challenge.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just one more thing. It was you, just to wrap up your DC analysis or your auction DC, you know, as far as the pitching you got in the reserve rounds, I just had a question for you. So you already have some guys who potentially have some roles. So Pyamps, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name, but, you know, he might have a potential. You got like Gill or Heel and Beater, you know, all of a sudden they might be viable. So, you know, you never know, right? You thought maybe you were drawing dead, but all of a sudden you have multiple live arms potentially in your reserve round. And then the one guy I wanted to ask you about was Lance Lynn. He was your first reserve round pick. I got him for $1 in one of the OLACs. I was fortunate to be off him last year. I'd been on him in years prior when he was really good. Last year, I don't know what it was that spooked me, but I ended up not having any. So I don't have that that scar tissue, you know, from taking him last year. And it seems like a lot of people do, because he is the biggest potential profit pitcher starter right now, at least on my file, with him only going for $1. Do you see, like, what do you see in him? Do you think people have overreacted here to his poor year last year and his previous 4 years of track record is kind of being forgotten? Like, what's your take on Lynn?
Yeah, you know, I don't think that might actually be my first share of him. More of just kind of, I wanted like a quantity of streamable starting pitchers. Like, I definitely don't plan on just having Lynn in my lineup every week or anything like that. But it's just, I wanted to have like four or five starting pitchers on my bench that I can choose from for any advantageous matchup. And I know Lance Lynn's going to pitch, or at least I think I know. But he's, you know, very reliable from a workload standpoint. So it's just more kind of like comparing him versus the other available starting pitchers. Once we entered the reserve rounds, it felt like he was just a tier above, because there is that upside there. Like you mentioned, like, I don't think anyone would be surprised if he just went back to being the guy he was before last year with the Cardinals. But there's also just that, like, I know this guy's in the rotation. You know, worst comes to worst, I think I can start him against, you know, 28, 27 teams or so. You know, I wouldn't want to start him against the obvious, you know, Dodgers, you know, Atlanta, whatever. But sure. It was just kind of comparing him to the rest of the starting pitchers available.
Yeah, no, I think that's important. You know, like, I think I got him for $1 at the end. And yeah, he looked like the best available that maybe I can get a few starts out of. And he's someone, like, you know, we said earlier, if I throw him out there in a favorable matchup at home and he burns me, that'll be it. I can cut bait for $1 and I'll move on to, you know, to the next. But if he comes out hot and has a couple, you know, good home starts, he goes five and, you know, one or two runs, gets a win, then, you know, he's already paid off $1. So yeah, there's some guys out there like that sometimes you can take advantage of other people's pain. You know, if they had these players last year and you didn't, it's easier for you to get back in than if you were the one who had them last year. And it's really hard to step on that potential minefield again. So that's just another psychological part of the game.
That's kind of what I thought I was doing. And good for you for not drafting in November and December. But that's what I thought I was doing when I got Lucas Giolito in like three of my first DCs when he was a free agent. I was like, look, I didn't have him last year. And maybe the Dodgers sign him and maybe I'll be laughing all the way to 220 Ks. And that didn't work, but same idea.
Yeah.
Okay, Mark, this has just been fantastic. Very instructive. I would say a masterclass on auction strategy. So I hope everyone got as much out of it as I did. Thanks for joining me, man. And I guess I'll see you on Thursday or a week from tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, hope it was instructive and useful for folks. And yeah, get into those auctions. It is the most fun and just another way to play the game that you can really get a lot of satisfaction out of when you are able to kind of figure it out. And yeah, I'll see you in Vegas in a week. Can't wait.
All right. That's Mark Winoker and I'm James Anderson, and I'll have another episode for you next week. Brought to you by Fantrax.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.